Okay, thank you very much. And thank you very much for the organizers to put all this together and to invite me. And sorry that we just ended up showing up only about 2 hours ago. Unfortunately, not everybody is as generous as the Fields Institute and these organizers. At the very last minute, I had to review 3 very long DOE proposals for many millions of dollars. And so, unfortunately, I just finished them at 3 a.m. this morning. So if I fall asleep now, please wake me up, okay? Anyway, so I want to give you an overview of various things one can do with rigorous high-order methods in dynamical systems. And so as a warm-up example, here is a picture that you have all seen many times. This is an approximation of the Hinong attractor by just iterating a point many times, throwing away the first iterate. And then you get a structure like this, as we all know. And then one can also, if one tries this on a large grid, one can establish some approximation of a trapping region for this. But of course, this is in no way rigorous. In fact, what is happening is we are approximating commuting diagrams by doing some arithmetic on the floating point numbers that does not really have much to do from a mathematical point of view with the arithmetic that we are really interested in. Now, this can be remedied by a method that has by now a long history, 50 years of it, starting mostly with the work of Ray Moore by including real numbers into pairs of floating point numbers and then performing addition on and multiplications and intrinsics on these sets of numbers. And in that way, one can make these diagrams commute exactly. So one performs an interval inclusion. Now, this can also be used for sets. So if you have any set in the reals that is compact, you can enclose it by, or in Rn, of course, can enclose it by intervals, and then the same things hold. And now one can try to use this to get an understanding of this attractor. And here we have a polygon of 4 straight lines that was found by Mr. Hinong and shown to map into itself. The interior of that polygon maps into itself, and you can see what happens if you cover this with lots of intervals. Well, you start to recover the structure of this attractor, but it does not really quite map into itself. And as you do higher iterates, you recover more of the structure, but on the other hand, the overestimation really prevents you from getting anything that maps into itself at all. So this built-in pessimism in the interval methods leads to a quite large overestimation, so things start to get worse after a few iterates, and they get worse yet. Now, the main problem of the interval methods is that one cannot account for the fact that sometimes intervals represent functions that depend implicitly on the same variable. This is the famous overestimation problem. And this can be remedied to a very large extent by using a projection from not only sets but from function spaces into Taylor polynomials and then outfitting these with a rigorous enclosure of the error. Now, if one has just Taylor polynomials, one can make diagrams commute, and for free, we even get some analysis operations out of this. And then we can adjoin an interval that encapsulates all the errors that you make in this projection. And by doing so, one obtains, again, rigorously commuting diagrams. But if the domain on which this function lives is small enough, then this can be exceedingly small, and one can retain all the information, or most of the information, about the dependency. Now, if one uses this for this particular system, turns out one can represent this polygon simply as an image of a suitably chosen two-dimensional second-order polynomial in this two-dimensional space living on minus 1, 1. And then if one takes this and iterates it forward and subdivides domains as necessary, one already in the first enclosure gets, in the first iterate gets a nice enclosure, and one can push this much further and obtain enclosures of the attractor like so. In the third iterate it looks like so, in the fourth and fifth it looks this way, and by now the errors in the remainders are still much, much smaller than the resolution of this method and than the resolution of this picture here, and hence this provides a really sharp enclosure from the outside of what this attractor looks like. Now, another example where one can see better what is happening is in this Hinon map. Now, we set this constant here to be 1 in magnitude because that makes the Hinon map area preserving, and then the contraction doesn't wash away overestimations that might otherwise occur. In this example, we are now looking at something connected to this five-island structure, namely something made by 4 points that define the corners of a rectangle. And if we just iterate these forward, then they produce, 3 of the points produce an island structure, while the fourth produces what looks like a surface. And so if one tries to then map forward this rectangle, then this is a great test for whatever method you have to see how well it behaves, because eventually the one point, the one corner that was trapped on this surface will lag more and more behind, while the others are, of course, confined to the islands. Now, here is an example of this situation with Taylor models of order 5. So these are representations that are linear in the independent variables and have just the remainder bound. And you can see already after 5 iterates, you have quite some overestimation, and it gets worse and worse as we iterate further. On the other hand, if you do this with Taylor models of order 20, so polynomials of order 20, then you can, in this approach, do 19 iterates, and you get somewhat deformed structures where indeed one corner has a tendency to lag behind, but overestimation is very well controlled because dependency is largely accounted for by what happens in the individual variables that are just part of the polynomial. Now, of course, this example is made to break things, so also this method breaks, so basically over more than 19 iterates, it is not possible to expand this thing in a Taylor expansion in reasonable order anymore. Actually, I was wrong, it works up to about 29 iterates, but then when this starts to happen, one can automatically start splitting domains. When the remainder bounds get too big in one iterate, one just decides cleverly how to split the domain and then continues. And by doing so, one can go much, much further. So one starts to see these things split into subregions, and you can continue and do this up to 120 iterates and produce rather pretty looking pictures, each one of which has individual submaps that are visible here but not really well visible here. So with a modest number of Taylor models, about a few hundred in this case, one can represent this structure quite nicely. Now, this approach has many applications, and I want to show a few of them here. The first one is an approach to make normal form methods that we're familiar with rigorous in the following sense. So whatever the normal form method gives you, we outfit with a remainder bound that has the property that under iteration things are mapped into itself and hence constrained for any further iterate that we may be interested in. Specifically, we use a normal form to obtain a polynomial approximation of an unstable manifold of a hyperbolic system with a fixed point here, and then outfit this with a test remainder bound and see if this object is mapped into itself, or more specifically, the upper and lower edges do not touch the upper and lower edges here, and those edges certainly exit the side edges. And if you can do that, then you have constrained the unstable manifold in this object, and for that matter also in this object. And so, if you're able to get a good short-term approximation of this manifold by a normal form method or whatever you like, then you have a good chance of getting a very good starting enclosure, and with this starting enclosure then you can iterate further and as necessary start splitting the domain if you start to come to the point where the expansion over one region does not converge anymore. So doing this, we can actually obtain also an inner enclosure of this attractor here by just starting with the unstable manifold, and I don't want to get too much into the mathematical details. Actually, this kind of summarizes the splitting mechanism. So if the result of one iteration has either a length or a remainder bound that is beyond a certain tolerance, you just split. So the approach here is not to kill the problem by having enough expansion order, which has been done by other estimates for manifolds. Rather, it's more like a analytic continuation principle, where you have rather quick convergence over small regions, and then you just patch these small regions together next to each other. So this is the approach, and doing this will lead to something like this. Here is a representation of the unstable manifold to a certain length, which is in our previous picture very similar to the red curve, which was an outer enclosure, and now we are adding further copies of stable manifold and fill up the picture just as we expect and obtain rigorous enclosures of the stable manifold of the Hinon map until we run out of power, which happens approximately here. All these enclosures of the stable manifold are still rigorously guaranteed to be of an accuracy less than about 10 to the minus 6, so still way below printer resolution, and this approach is only limited by the underlying floating point arithmetic. This is done with conventional double precision arithmetic. I had hoped for this meeting to have available already a new version where this is done with higher than double precision, and then obviously you can go longer than this and obtain sharper estimates yet. But already this is a pretty nice looking picture, and this is all mathematically rigorous, although of course done on the computer. Now here, a zoomed in version where one can see all kinds of things. For example, nice near tangencies at a variety of different places. And here is a further zoom where we are now in a rather small region where these individual things look quite linear. And now one can do further things with this, namely use these manifold pieces to make little rectangles, topological rectangles that are just given by the boundaries of one of these substructures here, and then study their mapping properties and hence learn about the entropy of this system. So Now, this is, I don't have to tell you much about this. This audience is very familiar with symbolic dynamics. We use these curvilinear rectangles that have homoclinic points in their corners. So they're just formed by two pieces of stable manifold and two pieces of unstable manifold. And so how can we then determine the detailed dynamics of this? Well, we have to find all homoclinic points of this manifold tangle, which is essentially a rigorous global optimization problem. I will say a little bit how to do this with Taylor models further down. And then one has to determine parent-child relationships of these homoclinic points. And if one takes two sets of homoclinic points, one of the nth iterate and one of the n plus first iterate, then every homoclinic point of the nth iterate needs to have a child in the n plus first iterate. And then one can determine how these topological rectangles map, and also one can untangle this complicated manifold structure. And this is done here. This is now the same topological object, just the stable manifold is stretched out, and the spacing between adjacent homoclinic points on the stable manifold is kept equal, and this is the unstable manifold trying to wrap itself around. Here in an example of 30 homoclinic points. Now, then one can define little topological rectangles, or those are actually the rectangles that one saw in the original system, except here they have a very easily identifiable structure, and one can look at their images, and this defines rigorously symbolic dynamics. So here is another such rectangle and its image up here, and so it continues. So this one has this rectangle up here, has a nice rectangle that crosses three regions, and so forth. So one can do all this totally automated. Here is another example with a few more homoclinic points, and one obtains rather pretty looking structures. We like to refer to these as Henon's brain, so they look a little bit like a brain. So we are untangling Henon's brain here. Okay, and can play more games, and some of these images look rather pretty, in particular this one. It looks a little bit like an octopus that lost five of its legs. We have only three legs left, and here is the body of the octopus. So all kinds of interesting things happen. And some more. So anyway, so doing this, one can get rigorous entropy estimates. And one of the things we are now attempting to do is automate this so much that one can even do it, well, first of all, totally automatically for any choice of parameters. And then we also want to determine all the homoclinic points and all the manifolds as functions of the parameters, which can be done in this Taylor model world by just viewing the two parameters as two additional variables. And then you just get, then the thing just behaves exactly in the same way, but the entire manifold tangle that is rigorously enclosed now also is depending on two parameters. And in this way, one can actually, hopefully soon, obtain estimates of the entropy over entire ranges. Okay, now, the function algebra inclusions have the other property that there is an operation that is tied to differentiation and integration that naturally appears in these function spaces, and that allows you to, in the end, treat ODE problems in basically the same mechanism as discrete problems. How does this work? If we want to look at ODE integration with Taylor models, so for dynamical systems, the trick is that we retain the full dependence on initial conditions over a finite and hopefully large enough box as a Taylor model, hence a representation of as a polynomial in initial conditions with a rigorous remainder error enclosure. Okay, and so in this approach, we hopefully can get enclosures of the flow of the ODE over sufficiently large times. And now, how does this work in principle? The most straightforward method is by just in the common way rewriting the differential equation as an integral equation. And now, if you take this operator and operate it finitely many times on the polynomial space, then you obtain convergence. In fact, if you work to order n, you obtain convergence in exactly order n, in exactly n steps. And then, on using this as a this resulting polynomial that is invariant after further iterations, we try to determine a rigorous enclosure of the error. And this polynomial, of course, again also depends on initial conditions. And so for this, one just needs a microscopic amount of functional analysis, namely Schauder's fixed point theorem. And so we construct a set of compact and convex functions, and then prove that that set is itself by this operator that is known to be continuous, and hence a fixed point exists in that particular neighborhood. And so the way it is done is we first, as we mentioned, obtain this polynomial that represents an approximation of the solution up to order n. And then once we have that polynomial, we just attempt to outfit it with an interval that is hopefully large enough so that when we apply this operator involving elementary operations and integration on this Taylor model, the thing is mapped into itself. And of course, since this polynomial is up to order n already mapped into itself, the chances for this succeeding are quite good, and in fact one can even make very good precise heuristics how you choose I and how you choose the step size for this to essentially never fail. It's not guaranteed that it will never fail, but if it does, it tells you, and then you just have to redo your proof, but it is quite robust. Now, once you have a first enclosure, then you have to, you can, if you want to, iterate one more time, and necessarily the enclosure must shrink in the process, and you just do this until you have achieved sufficient accuracy. Now, we apply this. I mentioned I had to review all these proposals for DOE and couldn't just say no, because these folks give us a lot of money to apply these techniques for some particle accelerators. Here is our biggest particle accelerator in North America, Fermilab, west of Chicago. And so this is essentially a dynamical system where one actually computes a Poincaré map, Poincaré return map, and then needs to show stability for something like 10 to the 9 or so iterations, or 10 to the 10 iterations through this Poincaré map. So this is done by obtaining a rigorous enclosure of this Poincaré map, which is now living in six-dimensional space, three positions, three momenta. It's a symplectic system. And then how can one... Yeah, and then this is actually an example of such a Poincaré map around a fixed point. All these machines are built to have a nice fixed point, and you see, so you have nearly elliptical structure that then eventually breaks down. There are high period fixed points appearing and all the good stuff that you know from symplectic systems or Hamiltonian systems. And now the trick is to force this motion as much as possible into a linearized motion. And so you can turn an object like this into something like this. Now, of course, this forcing into linearized motion does not quite work. Obviously, in most cases, these things are non-integrable, and so this works up to a certain error. But if this error is small, and if you can estimate it, then you can make rigorous guarantees for stability of this system for a finite and hopefully long enough time. So, specifically, we estimate the size of the invariant defect, so the amount to the extent to which this thing is not really an invariant. And then one just does a little bean counting argument. If one has such bounds for certain regions here, one can just add up stability times for subregions to obtain total stability. Now, this is, in essence, boils down to a large, complicated optimization problem. Namely, we try to find a rigorous upper bound for this invariant defect, which is essentially the Euclidean norm, Euclidean norm of the difference of the map of the radius in normal form space before and after application of this Poincaré return map. So sometimes these things look like this, and you, I guess, will believe me that it's not so easy to find a rigorous bound for something like that. And so, furthermore, this problem has an extreme cancellation problem in the sense that basically all the effects that turn this into something that is nearly circular, they have a tendency, all these effects cancel out each other. And so this circle is obtained as the consequence of a huge amount of arithmetic in the end, in the order of something like 10,000 floating point operations, all of which cancel out until we are back at nearly the same radius where we started. Okay, so this is a very challenging optimization problem. And it turns out that if one attempts this with conventional rigorous global optimizers, it does not really work. So you can only go to something like four dimensions of the space of interest. And after a large amount of CPU time, it still cannot complete and gives up. On the other hand, the ability of the Taylor models to retain this dependence on initial conditions to a very large extent allows you to overcome this issue, this dependency problem, and you can do the six dimensions in a moderate amount of CPU time. I mean, this is still not anything to sneeze at. In fact, it takes just about as long to run this as the particles to be stable in the accelerator. So some folks just, well, don't bother, just put them in there and see if they stay, and you get the answer similarly quickly. Except then, if you do that, then you don't know why it didn't work, if it doesn't work. Okay, so this is actually another picture of this normal form defect function in a slightly more well-behaved situation where the local minima and maxima are more easily manageable. But you see here, this happens at a scale of 10 to the minus 10. So the normal form space is roughly of magnitude 1. And then you have invariance of this approximate invariant to a level of about 10 to the minus 10. And then you have to bound this case, but it could in the end be done, and one could prove a sufficient number of stable turns for this machine. Now, this is connected to the Taylor model-based verified integrator, and now this has seen improvements recently, and this is a little bit more for the people interested in how these verified integrators really work. So there are now various new tools in there. First of all, it turns out that with some tricks from mathematics, one can make this more efficient by separating the problem into finding a solution for the reference orbit only, which is just a one-dimensional polynomial in time, and then separately worrying about the phase-based dimensions that one wants to transport. So one first obtains an invariant polynomial just for the reference orbit, which is again done by iterating this Picard operator in a polynomial space, but now only in a space of dimension 1. And then one looks at the nonlinear flow around this, so in relative coordinates. And this is actually, in the normal case, the most expensive case. But if we go to relative coordinate, then we are in the nice situation that the ODE is, by definition, origin preserving. And then one can apply a simple trick that goes back to the structure of the relation operation that exists on that space. First of all, to be a little bit more specific, so here is our the way we set this up. So the true solution is the center solution plus some perturbation solution, which then is preconditioned to make it numerically more stable. And then one obtains, of course, an ODE for this R prime wiggle in such a way. And now the goal is to evaluate the ODE of this in Taylor model arithmetic. And because the thing is origin preserving, we have an interesting thing, namely that one can apply the Lie derivative approach. What is this? Well, in general, if you have any observable in space, then you can get a Taylor expansion of its propagation in time with this operator that is essentially the gradient times the right-hand side of the ODE, and if there's time dependence, you have this extra term, and it's just an exponential operator of this. But the interesting thing is now, in this polynomial space, this operator can be just dealt with in a totally automatic way, and because P is origin preserving, the order that is lost here is automatically restored. And that's the trick why these relative coordinates are useful. And in that, this way, one can get the solution of these perturbation equations very, very easily, even if the right-hand side is complicated, because one needs only one evaluation of this P. Okay, so each term in this Lie derivative sum requires V plus one derivation operations. They're very cheap. And it requires V multiplication, but only one evaluation of F to set up the ODE. And so for complicated ODEs, this is much more efficient. Now, then another thing that goes to the core of what makes these methods work well is not only keep the errors in a remainder bound, but introduce additional variables that attempt to keep control of how the errors evolve long term in time, the so-called error variables, very intuitive name for what we're trying to do. And so we write the solution as a polynomial in the phase space variables and error variables, and those error variables we keep only linearly. In this way, after every iteration step that produces the local remainder bound, we can try to absorb this remainder bound into the error variables, and that has very positive consequences for the long-term behavior of the growth of the error enclosed by these error variables. So formally, this is just a bunch of mathematics. Don't worry too much about it. It comes down to the problem of finding an efficient representation for the sum of two parallel epipeds. And the algorithm that we are using for this recently is the so-called P-sum algorithm, which selectively determines the edges or the coordinate system of the box that encloses everything in terms of suitably chosen vectors out of the, in this case, four vectors that span the individual objects. Namely, we start with the longest vector that appears and then take that vector of the remaining three that is most orthogonal to it, and so forth. And by doing that, so if we are in this particular situation and want to calculate the sum of this and this, then the result is enclosed in this. In this case, both the two vectors are chosen from the green-yellow object. But as the box gets a little bit bigger in this example, then suddenly this is still the largest vector, but the vector that is most orthogonal of the remaining ones is this one. And then this one takes over to define the resulting box. And so this method has, for the aficionados of these methods, the same asymptotic behavior as the QR method, but it produces a behavior that is more similar to the parallel epiped method when that method is applicable. and usually has estimates that are better than both. Here is some information about the cost of these methods, but let's skip about this. And then here, this summarizes the behavior of the approach. This is the latest method based on error parameterization for a particular example. Let me not go into the details. And here is the error growth as a function of the step number. Here is the error growth for a previous method that we had based on preconditioning of the remainder terms. And then here are two methods before that. Okay, and so obviously this one looks a lot better than this one. Okay, now then we had already alluded to this. To really solve complicated problems, you need to have an automatic fashion to decompose the domain that you work with. Roughly speaking, whenever you leave the territory where your functional dependence of final conditions on initial conditions, where that becomes too complicated, instead of trying to increase the order, you just make the domain smaller and continue to propagate two objects instead. Okay? Now let's look at some examples how this works for a toy problem. Well, we have a new movie. This is one of our old examples. Every new thing we try, we apply to this system, and some of you have seen this numerous times, but every time we add a little bit, and so it is this time. Here's our Volterra equation. And now this time we have a really big box that we propagate to an end time of 3.5. Here is the result. You can't quite see it so well, but it consists of lots of little decomposed boxes. And what is interesting is to see the time evolution of this box, which is here shown in many substeps, namely those substeps that the integrator chooses, and to see where it splits. So originally this red box just moves in time and gets deformed, but it does not split. Here you start to see some green color. That means that in this region somehow the system has split once, and then down here it splits for a second time, and more splits happen as we come here. This example was chosen in a particularly nasty way because a little bit of this box, namely this part, lies on the other part of a bifurcation where the behavior of this solution totally changes. In fact, in this picture here, this box actually straddles this axis, and part of the solution is then trapped on this side, and the other part of the solution wants to run away on this side. So it makes it particularly interesting. That's why you have this pretty stretching here. Okay, and here is a magnification of the end solution, again seeing these different decomposed pictures. Here are some more colorful stuff. Here you see all the individual pieces and their time steps, so this looks very complicated, but the bottom line is that each little piece gets propagated further and further until it finally settles at the end time of where it needs to go. So all these things propagate independently, and in the end they settle on this structure that we had seen before. Now here is another example, a big box that is however now on only one side of this set of constraints. So this box will always be contained in the outer and inner green lines here, and the center point of this box will follow the middle green line. And if you look at the evolution of this, after some time you have an unsplit Taylor model, and it continues, is still not split, moves down here, not split. Here, now all of a sudden it starts to split itself automatically into two of them. Then it proceeds further, splits itself into three, starts splitting into more, because the dynamics becomes more complicated. And then by the time the center point returns, you have something like 10 or 12 objects here, some of which have quite complicated nonlinear structures. I mean, look at this one. This is a quite drastic nonlinear object here, and so is this one. So it finds automatically the right balance between how much nonlinearity can I carry without affecting my remainder bound negatively, or when am I better off to just split? And so now you can continue to run this. So this object now continues like so, and of course this system has a complicated dynamic, so by now the mapping of that little box further down is so complicated that we have already several dozen boxes, and now this is the second return, and we have approximately 100 boxes and a rather complicated dynamic. So while the center point returns to itself, the point that was here has advanced all the way here, and this point here lags behind and touches here. This point actually is mapped to here, which does not quite touch the green line if you look really carefully. And then basically this strange fishtail here is the image of this edge. All this, again, is of course fully mathematically rigorous. All these are totally rigorous enclosures that are obtained automatically. Now, let us now come to another example that is a quite complicated ODE. This object here is Apophis, the god of darkness and chaos of the old... Whoops, I am sorry, I'm moving too fast here. What happened? I hit the wrong button. Okay, the god of darkness and chaos of the old Egyptians, and it looks a little bit like a manifold with self-homoclinic points, so some prohibited kind of thing. These Egyptians were way ahead to what we know, so they had manifolds that crossed themselves. So Apophis was the deification of darkness and chaos, it was viewed as a giant snake, very fitting to the kinds of objects that we obtain as flows here. And that name was chosen for a bad near-Earth asteroid that was found in 2004. And as this godness, this god of darkness and chaos does, it visits on a Friday, the 13th, April 13th of 2029. Now at that time it will have a near collision with Earth, but will not collide from all we know so far. But then after that, every 7 years it comes back, and the next return is again on the 13th, so April 13th always, every 7 years. And so there is an interesting resonance. In these 7 years, Earth has made 6 revolutions, and so the resonance is 6 revolutions of the Earth versus 7 of, no, I'm sorry, 6 of the asteroid versus 7 of Earth. And that sets up very interesting resonance effects, and this is what we're going to study now. So we have a project with Politecnico di Milano to develop a verified integrator for the solar system dynamics that uses all these tricks, including all the true influences of planets, major asteroids, general relativity, and everything that is known, and then apply this to the study of this asteroid. And now, just, yeah?
We'd like to know how big the asteroid is.
I will, this is how big it is. Well, of course, that is a non-quantitative. It's about 100, yeah, right, something like that. So, it's not that big, but wait until you see what these things can do. Here is, this is our friend Jupiter, being hit by the fragments of what was one asteroid but then broke apart and is known as asteroid, no, actually it was a comet, I'm sorry. It's a Shoemaker-Levy, yeah. And so, now Jupiter is a pretty big object, but these are the impacts of this asteroid, so you don't want to have anything like that happen on Earth. If it does, then you get something like this thing in Siberia, the Tunguska event, where one doesn't quite know what it was, but it's kind of believed that this was a big asteroid that flattened all these trees, and then this is definitely a known impact of a body, but this was only believed to be about 12 meters, okay? So scale that by a factor of 20 to the third power because the mass scales with that and you get a pretty big hole. Okay, and you don't want to be near that hole, that's for sure. So, now, for this problem, one has to understand how these Kepler systems behave, and roughly speaking, what they do is they like to elongate a lot in the direction of motion. That's also what happened to Shoemaker-Levy, so it got pulled apart by getting into some gradient of gravity, and then the individual fragments just lined up in the direction of motion, and then you see here a box that is propagated a few times, and you see how much this really elongates, and then this is being transported here with domain decomposition. So this is the mechanism that makes these things difficult, and as you propagate them further, they get longer and longer, and you kind of lose track of how they decompose, and but basically every one of these lines is an image of this box represented by a few decomposed boxes. Here's a magnification where you see how it splits itself in the evolution. So, we have seen this. April 13 is the day, 2 days before tax day in this country. And here are now some of the results. So, here you have a representation of the Earth orbit and Apophis orbit, and then every 7 Earth years and 6 Apophis revolutions, they come very close to touching each other. So, this is the situation at the time of the first enclosure. Here is actually a representation of this object as obtained from the Taylor models. For those of you interested, this is the width of the interval enclosure from now until integrated until 2029. And you see this oscillating. That just happens to be every revolution of Apophis. So at the, I forget which one is which, but at the close point to the sun, you are on one side, and at the far point, you're on the other. And unfortunately, I forgot which one is which. But anyway, you see this repetitive pattern, and so this interval enclosure grows to about 10 to the minus 4 astronomical units, which is already pretty big. And then now here is the situation as we get close to the actual collision. So now we are looking at this in the coordinate system of the Earth, and what you see is that here is the domain box of this object, and then as it passes Earth, what happens is that it becomes exceedingly wide, just because, I mean, the phenomenology is simply that the part of the box that is closer to Earth sees a much stronger gravity than the box that is far away, and so then this leads to an elongation. That's this resonance effect that makes everything so bad, and that makes the prediction of what happens at the next iterate very complicated. So here is the situation of the error, the integration error, and you see by the time we have this close encounter, of course it goes up. This is another error in position on a larger time scale, and you see that here everything is behaving in a similar way, and then here things behave differently as we get close. Now, here is the situation of the detailed integration, and now this picture looks a little bit busy, but yeah, here is again Earth shown to scale. I'm not sure if the continents are at the right place, but we leave this to our imagination. And so here is the object coming in with its phase space shown in the interior of this rectangle, and then as it starts to get close, all of a sudden the domain splitting happens. The domain becomes too big to be integrated in one piece, and then you have, I believe, 3 or 4 pieces coming out here, where the red are the center lines. You also see that the step size that is chosen decreases, which is to be expected, and then later increases again. Here is a step size of all the individual fragments, so things are going well here. Then they become very small. In fact, this is log 10 in days, so you have a change of nearly 4 orders of magnitude in step size. And just about here at the closest encounter, then we have these several boxes developing, and now each one of these has its own step size, where the object that remains closest to the sun then continues on with the smallest step size, and so then each of these has their own little step size afterwards. The important thing is there's no integration failure, so the thing works through. We have proper domain splitting. The error stays in an acceptable width, and everything is mathematically rigorously verified to the extent of the accuracy of this system. And this process takes about 10.6 hours on a single machine, so this is not that bad. And the solar system model is really the best there is, so everything is in there that the astronomers believe in. Now, then here is the remainder error size. Before this close encounter, it was in the neighborhood of 10 to the minus 12. Afterwards, it jumps to about 10 to the minus 6, and now you see these several boxes here, but 10 to the minus 6 is still quite manageable. And then this is the integration further along. So if we have no impacts during one close encounter, then the question is, of course, what happens down the road in further close encounters? And now you see here what happens. These are snapshots of the initial conditions before a close encounter, and then the close encounter happens, and very suddenly, because of this strong stretching, the phase space that is occupied gets elongated quite dramatically, and then on top of this, the slipping happens. So whenever you have a spread that was originally radially, this is going to be turned into an azimuthal spread. That's what's happening here. Okay, and now the challenge is to take this and integrate it to the next possible close encounter in 2036 and see what happens there, and then study what happens to this resonance condition, and then continue to to subsequent close encounters. So this was it. I hope I have given you a little bit of an overview of what these rigorous integrators can do. I focused somewhat on applications today, except for the problem with the entropy. But we're moving in general in a direction where these methods can really be used to transport flows of even complicated ODEs over non-trivial times and instill manageable computational effort. Thank you very much.